All right. This is file 25, cycle 3. Today's date is March 6th, 2018. This is Jean McMillan. I am interviewing Nick Pohl from the Housatonic Youth Service Bureau. He is the current director. He's going to talk about the Service Bureau and the changes that he's made since he took over from Cynthia Bianchi. But first, we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
My name is Nick Pohl.
It'll pick up. Great. It will pick up. Okay. And when were you born?
I was born September 1st, 1977.
And your birthplace?
Chicago, Illinois.
Your parents' names?
Bob and Anne Marie.
Was your father a Robert or was he an actual Bob?
I believe it's technically Robert.
Robert, but yeah. He was always called Bob.
Yeah, and depending, different people called him different things.
Oh, like, yeah.
His parents called him Bobby. My mom calls him Rob.
Okay. I can deal with that.
Everybody in his congregation calls him Bob.
Yeah.
So he has never had really a consistent moniker, but I think technically it's Robert.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Anne Marie, and it's Anne with an E.
Yes.
Okay. And her maiden name was?
Her maiden name was Gagnon.
Okay, G-A-G. All right. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have three brothers.
And their names?
I am the youngest of four, and my oldest brother is Christopher. The brother underneath him is Benjamin. And then the brother above me is Jonathan. And then there's me.
And then you. Yeah. The best of the lot.
That's right.
All right. Tell me a little bit about your career path that brought you to the Housatonic Youth Bureau.
Sure. Career path really started, I guess, with my education, which was an undergraduate degree in social work from Concordia College in Bronxville, New York. And then quite soon after that, I entered a master's degree program at Fordham University for my master's in social work. And I worked in Westchester County, New York for a couple of years after graduating Concordia, and while I was completing my master's degree, I worked at a school in Millwood, New York.
In which New York?
Millwood.
Okay.
The Devereaux Millwood Learning Center, and it was for students designated on the autistic spectrum. And I did that for a couple of years and had always wanted to go overseas and work overseas. So I accepted a job teaching English in Japan. And I spent a year in Japan teaching English, which I loved. It was a really great experience. Mm. And I could see myself at some point in my life or career possibly doing something like that again. So I spent a year teaching English in Japan in Oyama City, Japan, which is just northwest of Tokyo, about an hour outside of Tokyo. And following my contract there, I came back to the States and ended up working in the foster care system. I was working for a Massachusetts-based agency, and I started a new site in Greenfield, Massachusetts for their intensive level foster care program. And Greenfield is bordering Vermont, so I actually lived in Vermont at the time, lived in Brattleboro, Vermont. And this was about 2006-2007, and my daughter was born in 2000 2008. And after the birth of my daughter, her mom and I felt that we wanted to be closer to family, and her mom grew up in Cornwall, which brought us here. And around that time, I secured a job working with Primetime House in, they're based in Torrington, but this program was based out of Lakeville. Mm-hmm. And I was tasked with starting an supported employment program for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And while I was working there, I noticed the executive director job position at Housatonic Service Bureau, and I really wanted to move in an administrative track and give myself that mm-hmm. professional exposure mm-hmm. experience. So I was fortunate enough to get offered the position, and this was in 2010.
Did you have to apply for it, or an interview?
Yeah, I applied for the position, and it was there was a formal interview mm-hmm. process, and you know I believe there was a couple of candidates for the position, and I interviewed. It was a fairly large group, I can recall, mm-hmm. and at the time, the agency was located in a small white farmhouse.
The White House.
The White mm-hmm. House, as mm-hmm. it was called. I guess technically on the grounds of
yes.
the high school. I think
yes.
that's technically their
yep.
land still.
Yep.
But just on Warren Turnpike Road. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. very small. The administrative offices for pupil services, which administers the special ed delivery services
yep.
for the region, was located on the lower level of the farmhouse, and then on the upper level of the farmhouse, we were given three small rooms, probably at one point bedrooms.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And that's where the organization humbly began in 1991.
Well, actually, it began in the superintendent's office with a desk, a phone, and a phone book, according to Cynthia Bianchi.
Oh, interesting.
Then they moved to the White House.
Got it. Okay.
So you came in on the better end of the deal.
The pre-pre-history.
The pre-pre-history.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that must have been shortly after they were founded, though, that they moved
oh, yeah.
to the White
yeah.
House.
Yeah.
Because I think they were
6 months.
Oh, okay.
6 months.
Got it. Okay. And the White House was, we were very fortunate and blessed to be offered this space because
oh, yeah.
we weren't charged rent or anything. So that was great. And it was very convenient for the services that we were delivering. But it was an old farmhouse.
Oh, sure.
Complete with, you know, the sounds of scurrying feet in the walls
uh-huh.
to, you know, mice running around. It was very much an old farmhouse. So
that's where the capital fund drive must have come in.
That's really what precipitated that. And it was funny, there was a cat that used to live there.
I wonder why.
There was a cat, but the cat was clearly not doing its job because there was plentiful mice. And apparently I've heard stories of a raccoon or two that
probably
made its way into the building at some point. Yeah, and that cat almost followed the path of the organization. The cat was about 18 years old.
Uh-huh.
And when I came on board, the cat lived a couple more years and, you know, finally reached.
It didn't transfer to your new building.
No, it didn't make it to the new building.
Oh, dear.
But the Capital campaign really came out of, this is an interesting moment in the organization's history. I think it was like 2000 and probably it was 2014 where, going back to the farmhouse feeling, its age, the school district wisely made the determination of this building has
had to go
past its shelf life. It was time for it to go. It was even past renovating.
I think
I mean, it needed to be the amount of work that needed that was needed in that building was substantial. So it was a better option for them to just raise the building and construct a space for pupil services within the high school. So that's what they did. So they essentially said, you know, they gave us a year window. They said, you know, we're going to make this plan next year. You know, we're going to start construction, and pupil services is going to be out of here, and we're going to knock this building down in a year. So we really had 12 months. And it was, I think, fortuitous because we were given, you know, it produced anxiety when we found that out. But it also gave us motivation and gave us some fuel to embark on a fairly aggressive campaign, which I think served the organization and served the mission in a lot of different ways. We retained a consultant to help steer that campaign. And what we did as sort of an initial stage was to construct a a three-year strategic plan. And what came out of that strategic plan was really three initiatives. One was to construct a new space, expand staffing capacity, and establish a reserve fund. And this was a new experience for me. I had never been part of a major capital drive before. Many board members had not been. So it was a real
learning experience
for everybody involved. But it was something to see the board engage in a way that, you know, I thought was remarkable. People really stepped up in a variety of ways in this campaign. And it was successful certainly beyond
your
expectations. I think at the end of the day, we raised nearly $1 million. It was, I think, $975,000, I think, was the final tally.
That's a good amount of money.
Or close to that. And it was a really remarkable experience for the organization, not only from the fund development perspective, because it gave us the funding that we needed to construct a new space, which was the most critical challenge we were facing, but it also introduced and elevated our organization in a really unique way, because in part because I think the organization had such, you know, a humble beginning from starting at a desk, then moving to this farmhouse. So it really was a next stage in the evolution and the life cycle of the organization that has produced has produced really remarkable outcomes from just a fund development perspective, but also from a service capacity, because it elevated the awareness of our organization, not only to the donor community, but also to the community
the general,
at large, the general community. So families who had never even heard of our organization or didn't know what we did as an organization gave them a chance to learn about our mission, the work that we do, and then access our services. So all the way around, from our service capacity to our fund development capacity, I think even to our board capacity, it really strengthened the organization and broadened its reach in some pretty remarkable ways.
Good. Who are some of the board members that you work with?
Some of the board members that I work with currently, we have a phenomenal board chair, Nancy Bird, whose husband was a dentist for a long time.
Oh, yes, Dr. Bird.
Dr. Bird up in North Canaan. And Nancy's is great. She's a, I think she's everything that you want in board leadership. She really pulls her weight, and she is well regarded and respected in the community. She believes in, you know, not only our mission as an organization, but I think nonprofits in general. And I think she really understands the unique role that nonprofit organizations play in the Northwest Corner community. Nonprofit organizations are the social safety net, if I could use that word, for the Northwest Corner.
And we need it. We have many needs.
Absolutely needed. Chore service, women support services, all of these organizations are just playing a critical, critical role in supporting families and dealing with really challenging community issues. And I think Nancy really understands that and takes that to heart. And she's been great just from a leadership perspective, but also from a recruitment perspective, because she is very well connected. She's been an advocate for our mission and an advocate for getting some impressive board members involved with the organization. And we've had some long-time board members too, which has been interesting because there's this, you know, this institutional thread that runs back to the roots of this organization in people like Linda Sloan, who've been on the board
forever,
a long time, and Ron Dower.
He's another one,
on the board for a long time. Matt Meddy from Sharon, the Park and Rec director, he's been on the board for a long time. And there's some newer board members who have stepped up in really interesting ways. Adam Higgins is our treasurer. He's been a great asset. Bonnie Bello is transitioning her life up to the Northwest Corner. She had a pretty distinguished career working with the EPA, and she's an amazing person when it comes to communications, and that's added a lot of capacity for us.
Well, you've got a very strong board.
Yeah, there's Devereaux Chatillon. She's amazing. She's a an attorney, which is great.
I'm not going to ask you how to spell that one. I'll email you.
And there is Lance Beiser, who's been an amazing board member as well, and he is our secretary at the moment. And the community has just really rallied around this organization in unique ways. And we really saw that, I think, going back to the campaign for a second, is how much support there is for this organization and this community. And we got support from a lot of different sort of sections of the community, from individual donors, from the generous community foundations in our area, all the community foundations, Berkshire Taconic, the Community Foundation of Northwest Connecticut, Foundation of Community Health in Sharon, they all chipped in for this initiative. All of the towns chipped in for this initiative. And Roberta Willis, she can't go unacknowledged in that. She was instrumental in securing bond funding that largely covered the cost of construction for the new space.
And where is the new space?
We're located on the Housatonic Valley Regional High School campus. And if you pull into the campus and stay to the right, you will see a six-bay garage brick building. And that building was constructed, I think, in the mid-90s, something like that. And it was primarily used to house tractors and equipment for maintenance department. There was a second level put on there, but it was utilized. Well, it was utilized in a
non-productive way.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of storage. Robotics department was sort of using it, and it wasn't really a well-defined space.
It is
so
not.
After the Mahoney Hewitt Center was constructed and the robotics department moved over there, it was really a prime space for us to renovate. And it's been great because it keeps us on
campus.
The high school campus, which is ideal. And it's also at the same time a bit separate from the high school, which is important for a lot of students that we work with, because there's a level of confidentiality and anonymity that, you know, students typically want. They don't necessarily want their friends to know that they're meeting with somebody for counseling. So it really offers us a chance to deliver services in a way that is, you know, protects confidentiality and protects anonymity.
That's
which is
very
important.
Good. What are some of the changes that you have made when you took over in 2010?
Well, the amazing thing about Cynthia was how she was able to really do it all at the organization. She was the executive director, she was the counselor, she was doing programs. I mean, she really did it all, which was a really amazing accomplishment, and I think what the organization required and needed at that time. And she made my job easier in a way, because she did such an amazing job at establishing a firm and solid foundation in the community that I think the organization, and I'm convinced the organization still benefits from.
Oh, definitely.
Today.
Definitely.
Because it is an organization that is so ingrained in the community, and that's largely due to the amazing work of Cynthia and the founding board members.
It was
a grassroots initiative that launched this organization, and Cynthia, you know, embodies that in so many ways. The work that she did and the board did at that time really was a great service, you know, to the institution in general. I think it's something we still benefit from. When I came on board in 2010, one thing that we did, it was a strategic decision and move to create a designated executive director position, because I was thinking a lot about sustainability of the organization, in where if you have too much centralized in one person, you know,
you need to delegate.
You need to have, I think, in some level of redundancy, so not too much capacity is centralized in any one space, because if that person leaves, wins
then
the lottery, or whatever, there goes that institutional whatever. So what we did was, okay, let's create an executive director position that's a dedicated executive director position that can focus more intensely on fundraising and really growing the organizational capacity in delivering services. And then as a part of that, we created a clinical position. And that clinician did the counseling, ran the programs, and my position focused on some internal structures that needed to get developed, and then also a lot of relationship building with the donor community to increase our fund development capacity at the organization. So that was like the first big change that we did. And from there, we launched some new programs. We launched the Youth and Philanthropy Program, which is an interesting initiative in partnership with the Community Foundation of Northwest Connecticut. And it's an initiative that really introduces young people to the world of philanthropy. And it does that through kind of a three-step process, where we will gather a cohort of students at the start of the school year and work with the students on identifying a community need. That's where it starts. What are the needs you see?
And from their point of view. It's not
from
your
their point of view, which I think is it's generated entirely by the students. It's led entirely by the students. And then, because we want to really demonstrate how the world of philanthropy addresses needs within communities and really introduce that at a young age. So the students identify a community need, and then they devise a fundraiser. They figure out, okay, what types of fundraisers are there? What can we do? And they have a goal of raising $500. The final stage is a grant-making stage. And the grant-making stage is interesting because it takes their $500 and matches it with $2,500 from the Community Foundation of Northwest Connecticut. So you totally have $3,000 to give to an organization that addresses the community need that they identify at the start of the school year. The entire process takes about an academic year. So we'll work with a student cohort for the entire academic year. And part of that process, too, is learning about and evaluating different interventions. So they know they have this $3,000 grant to award to some organization. So it gives them a chance to learn about different organizations in the community that are doing something about the community need that they've identified. Mm-hmm. We'll ask, you know, maybe the executive director, should some organizations come in and speak mm-hmm. to the group.
Mm-hmm. Do a presentation.
They'll do some research on different organizations out there. And then once they've sort of done their due diligence and have made a decision on where they want the grant money to be directed, they make a recommendation to the foundation to say, this is where we want our $3,000 to go. And I'll give you an interesting example. One year, one cohort really wanted to tackle prescription drug abuse. They
Good.
Felt that was a challenge that they saw in the community and with their peers. So throughout the course of that academic year, they did their fundraising and they researched various interventions mm-hmm. That would address prescription drug abuse. And what they ended up doing was giving a grant to the McCall Center for Behavioral Health in Torrington to implement substance abuse prevention curriculum in the high school for the next year. So they were able to actually see and experience how complete circle from identifying the community need to raising the money to making the award to then seeing the intervention the next school year being implemented at the school.
After it was implemented at the school, did the program continue or was it dropped after a year or two?
It was the way that this was structured, it was a one-time grant.
Okay.
And what we did was we baked it into the health curriculum, where a trainer from McCall and facilitator from McCall would come into the health classes and do a specific evidence-based curriculum for the students in the health classes. So we sort of augmented the health curriculum with adding this component.
Wonderful. Tell me about the summer intern program. That's another new program.
This is an exciting program that's, I think, in its fourth or fifth year now. And it began really simply, really humbly, with a conversation that I had with, at that time, the director of the Sharon Historical Society.
Liz Shapiro.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was Liz. And I knew Liz. We had a good relationship. And she called me up and said, hey, I want to start an internship thing. What do you think? Like, great.
Oh,
let's give it a shot. So we started the first year with two interns at the Historical Society
mm-hmm.
in Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
And it grew from there.
Good.
And the way the program is structured is we will actually recruit and start working with a cohort of students even before the summer starts. And we'll start in like recruiting the students first, and then we'll move into like a stage where we introduce various learning modules. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the learning modules are professional development focused. They could be resume writing. They could be financial literacy. They could be stress management techniques. They could be workplace communication strategies. Whatever it is, you know, we devise a series of modules mm-hmm. that will start arming these students with practical skills that they can start applying and using when their summer internship starts. They need to complete 120 hours at a nonprofit in the community. Generally, that's aligned with their career goals. So, for instance, if we have a student who's maybe interested in working with animals,
yep.
we've partnered with Little Guild in the past. Or if we have a student who's interested in working with kids, mm-hmm. we've partnered with the Audubon. They help run the summer program for Audubon. And so they have 120 hours that they need to complete, and then we pay we give the student a grant at the completion of the program for $700, and the grant is really used for their personal growth, whatever that may mean for the young person. Some will apply that for school. Some will apply that for, oh, I want to buy a laptop, okay. or whatever. But something that's they earned it. And it's great. Mm-hmm. You know, I think last year we had half a dozen interns working in about the same number of nonprofit organizations. And nonprofit organizations really enjoy it because many organizations, kind of going back to what we were talking earlier, that are doing really critical services in the area, you know, they're limited staff. You know, they are stretched thin, and having an intern doing really meaningful work, whatever yep. that is, yep. Is adding value to the organization. So they like it because it increases their capacity to some degree. We love it because it engages and plugs young people into the community in a unique way. And the students like it too because
they get paid.
They get paid, but yeah. they also have a unique opportunity. These internships aren't jobs that, you know, students are going to be able to get otherwise. You know, right. they are really unique jobs, and we make sure that we're partnering with each nonprofit in a way that's going to construct an internship that's going to be meaningful. Mm-hmm. These aren't coffee fetching sort of internships.
Oh, no,
they're
no,
doing
no.
meaningful work yeah. for the organization. An example would be a genealogy project that we did with the Sharon Historical Society mm-hmm. where
yes.
A student created a website mm-hmm. for the nonprofit organization that was doing some genealogy work. We had another student, I think it was at the Sharon Historical Society, if I remember right, that was cataloging gravestones. So it was
yes,
really
yes.
interesting projects
yeah.
that students are able to get involved in.
It's on a different level than the summer youth program here in Salisbury,
yeah.
which has been going since 1972. And originally, it was for at-risk boys.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed over the time. But it's the same sort of thing, only I think your learning models are a more advanced level than perhaps what the summer youth program does. But it's in the same genre.
Yeah, what's also interesting, you know, about it, and it probably happens to some degree in the program here in Salisbury, pretty much every year that we've run the program, at least one student has remarked about either about how they didn't know this organization even existed.
Yeah.
One, so it educates them about their community. Mm-hmm. And two, what's also interesting is how oftentimes the student and the site supervisor, the supervisor at the nonprofit that's appointed to that responsibility, mm-hmm. develop a relationship
and
develop
that's good.
Like a mentor relationship.
That's a good possibility.
Which is great, mm-hmm. and it becomes a potential reference resource
yeah.
for the young person.
Yeah.
It becomes, you know, just a unique relationship that they share with somebody. It becomes a career, you know, development
mm-hmm.
tool where there's, you know, they're mentored in their professional internship role. So
it's a wonderful opportunity because it broadens their horizons in many ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you said that there were barriers to getting help, and you were specific about three and how they were resolved.
Yeah, everything that, you know, I think when I look at Husanaku Service Bureau, and what we do is we largely generate access. I think that's like a real focus that the organization accomplishes each and every day. And I think there are real access challenges in a rural community. And some that we've identified, and this is not just unique knowledge to us, but you know, a lot of people talk about the transportation challenges mm-hmm. out here. That's a big one. We also see cost as a barrier to access. Mm-hmm. And there's just limited service providers that we just need to acknowledge that fact of living in a rural community. There aren't as many service providers in more populated areas.
Sure.
It's just a fact. So those are like really three primary mm-hmm. access barriers that we've identified as something that we want to try to work around.
And how have you addressed the transportation problem?
Yeah, we've sort of like allowed these barriers to inform our services in a way mm-hmm. and allowed them to help shape our services in a way. And how we do that is, well, one, all of our services are free. So there's the cost. In terms of transportation, we've designed our programs and specifically our counselors as mobile. So they're going to all the elementary schools at least one day a week, and they're working with kids in their schools, which totally takes the transportation piece out of it for families. And then also, related to the transportation thing, is we're physically located.
Yeah.
Partly why we didn't want to move away from the high school campus is it because we're able to leverage the regional aspect mm-hmm. of the high school and work with young people from every town that we cover, which is six towns yeah. in a broad geographic area.
Oh, yes.
I was just trying to figure that out the other week. I think it's a 270 square mile mm-hmm. area that we cover.
It is a huge area.
From South Kent to North Canaan. So it's
oh, yeah.
huge.
Yeah.
So being for us to be able to leverage the capacity of the regional high school is huge for our
sure.
services. So we're able to work with teens from across our region during their school day or just after school at the high school. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece is limited service providers. And this goes back to the campaign mm-hmm. and how we wanted to increase service capacity, partially for this reason, because there are limited service providers. So we wanted to add an additional service provider. So we hired a second clinician. So we have two full-time licensed clinicians providing free behavioral health care in our community. So again, it's access, access, access,
oh, yeah.
so much of what we do. And a lot of our programs are great, you know, just at face value, but a bit of a backdoor kind of, you know, impetus to these programs is that they build relationships with young people. And it happens in a non-threatening way, where our clinical teams are running these programs, and they're building relationships with young people. And then many times out of that, mm-hmm. a counseling relationship will start.
Yeah.
They'll start meeting on a regular basis mm-hmm. and talk about, you know, really important and impactful things going on in their life. So again, it's just that access mm-hmm. piece.
Is there anything that you'd like to add to this before we close? Or have I covered most of it?
I think we covered a lot.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.